Well, thank you, Keith, for joining us this afternoon. I think, despite our struggles with the technology, I imagine you could sense the sort of complete attention that there was in the room, which is obviously testimony to the power of the story and the skillfulness of your filmmaking. Could I start by asking you something about the circumstances in which you came to make the film, and how the decision to make the film, well, was there any relationship between the decision to make the film and the campaign for justice, or was that there at the start, or did it come after?
Well, first, I want to thank everyone for allowing me to speak to you. It's been quite a journey, and this is a great therapy session for me. It's been over 29 years of my life dedicated to this particular case. But I come to you in the spirit of the late Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley and the legacy of her son, Emmett Lewis Till, for I believe, if not for the Emmett Till murder and the courageousness of my Shiro, we would not be a Keith Beauchamp filmmaker today. And without those who lost their lives throughout the ongoing struggle, civil rights struggle, the human rights struggle, we all would not have a path to follow. But my journey with Emmett Till happened when I was 10 years old. I grew up in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the Deep South in the United States. And I was in my parents' study, and I came across an old Jet magazine that they kept over the years. And I recall opening up the pages and discovering the story of Emmett Till. On one side of the page, there's this angelic face of this young little boy, sort of an image, splitting image of myself at that time. And on the other side of this page, there's this horrific face of this monster. I could not really understand what I was looking at, and just so happened, my parents were walking by the study, and they looked in on me, and my mother walks in, and she sees that I discovered the photograph, the horrific photo of Emmett Till. And then she calls my father into the study, and they both looked at each other, and they said to themselves, it is time to tell him the story. But throughout my life, the name Emmett Till kept resurfacing. When I got into high school, I was interracially dating. The first thing my parents would tell me before I left the house that night was, don't let what happened to Emmett Till happen to you. So it became an educational tool to teach me about the racism that still exists in our country and abroad today. But it wasn't until 2 weeks before my high school graduation, I have to say I had my real run-in with racism. And that was when I was assaulted by an undercover police officer for dancing with a white classmate of mine. And that's what spurred me into wanting to fight injustice, but I felt the only way that could be possible if I became a part of that system. So I began to study criminal justice at Southern University of Baton Rouge and helped to become a civil rights attorney. But then, towards my junior year of college, I was introduced to filmmaking by childhood friends who had moved to New York City and started their own film production company. So I told my parents, look, let me sit out a semester. If it didn't work out, I would go back, continue my education, go to law school as planned. And fortunate, at a company meeting, I was asked if there was a story that I would want to tell as a feature film, and I just want to be clear with that, because my life has come full circle. It was a story of Emmett Till. So when I made that decision to take on this case, this story, I visualized telling the story as a narrative feature. So in fact, when I made that decision, the first thing I said I needed to do was reach out to the family, in particular, Emmett Till's mother. At the time, especially in the United States, as well as around the world, people of color was talking about how our stories need to be told, and we had to be very careful that we didn't have, you know, our white counterparts appropriating the story. So I set out to tell the story by the people who lived it. So the first thing I did was reached out to Mother Mobley, Emmett Till's mother, Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley, I call it another moment. I had a side job. Everybody had a side job when they first started in the industry. But my side job was at Estee Lauder headquarters, a corporate job, which is crazy. Sitting there in the office, and I said I needed to, if I wanted to pursue this, I have to reach out to the mother. And I'm telling this story because it was very hard for me, being young, and making a decision like that, that I would reach out to someone that I deemed to be the mother of the civil rights movement. So I was very nervous. Picked up the phone, called her, and as soon as she picked up on the other line, I quickly hung up in her face. And that was because I didn't know what type of life she led since her son's passing. I didn't know if I was going to open up old wounds. I just didn't know her state of mind. And I sat at my office desk, fussing at myself for just hanging up on Mother Mobley. And I gathered myself, called the number again. She picked up. I immediately apologized to her and told her that was me that I called earlier and hung up in her face. And I explained to her why I was so nervous to talk to her. And I told her the story that I've just told you guys. And she asked me to calm down. And we ended up talking for 2.5 hours that first time. And that was early in 1995. And midnight, and then, I'm sorry, I'm long-winded. So this is therapy for me. I don't get a chance to talk about this unless I'm doing lectures and stuff. But when we talked on the phone, it just opened up a new world to me. What ends up happening, we meet face-to-face in 1996 for the first time. And what if she was here, she would say it was a love affair that we had because we were so connected mentally. And I was this young man in my early 20s, just, trying to find my way. And she became an adopted grandmother to me. And she has said that I sort of been that son to her. And for 8.5 years, she was my mentor and friend. But what something interesting happened in 1995, even before I actually met Mother Mobley face to face, I started traveling throughout the Delta of Mississippi, finding witnesses who have never spoke publicly about the case. The documentary itself was only, the footage that you saw was only supposed to be used as research materials for me to develop the screenplay. I developed the screenplay. And producers from Showtime, who worked with Showtime, optioned my screenplay, but they sat on it and it ended up being shelved. So for 3 years, I had no control of my possession, the story of Till. And because I was in the Mississippi Delta and I was finding new eyewitnesses and evidence to the case, it was with the encouragement of Mother Mobley that I take that footage that I captured and produce a documentary, which is how the Untold Story came to be. So I realized that I was not doing just capturing simple interviews. I realized I was capturing depositions, because a lot of these folks had never spoke again publicly before, and we're hearing from them for the first time. And so that project ended up taking, and talking about the documentary process, ended up taking 9 years of my life. Most of the time was taken trying to get eyewitnesses to trust me enough to tell their stories. For Simeon Wright, it took me 3 years to get him to talk to me alone. And so it was a process. Mm-hmm. And of course, eventually the Untold Story was reduced and I began to travel around the United States with a 30-minute work in progress of the film, which ultimately became a 90-minute piece and of course cut down to 70 minutes. But I would travel the country and show this 30-minute piece anywhere that I could. I wanted people to listen. I wanted people to remember Emmett Till and the importance of his story. And with the help of Mother Mobley, of course, I was able to have screenings at the United Nations and many different places where we had people of power with that we knew people of power would attend. And it just snowballed. City councils around the country began to pass resolutions in support of my efforts. Sororities and fraternities from universities got involved in the process. This film really encompasses what we could do collectively if we could come together. And this is why it's so important to understand the process of making this film. Because it wasn't just me hands-on editing and simply telling a story. Multiple people were involved, multiple leaders in our country was involved with the process as well. And that just became bigger than life. And ultimately, it led to the reopening of the case in 2004. But unfortunately, 1 year after Mother Mobley had passed away.
Well, it's your therapy, but it's absolutely fascinating for us. Can I just ask you one more question before we open it up? Which is to say, if we sort of go fast forward from 2004 to now, so now you continue to show the documentary now, but also in 2022 we have the feature film, which was always your ambition. That's a fantastic achievement. But it's a different moment. If you started in 1995, the politics, not least the sort of racial politics of now, is different.
That's right.
So are you able to reflect at all on the change in the meaning, or perhaps there has been no change in the meaning, whether or not there has been a change in the meaning of the story for you over that period of time?
Well, what's interesting is that my life has come full circle. It came at a place and time where if you're a God-fearing person, you believe there's a time and season for all things. One of the greatest insights that I had at an early age, thanks to Mother Mobley, who was clairvoyant, and I want to be clear about that, she actually told me what my journey was going to look like. She saw that I was going to get the case reopened before I understood and saw it myself. She actually told me what this journey would look like all the way until now. The hardest struggle that I had was to keep faith in myself and believe that her words would be true. And so that was the biggest challenge that I had over all these years, even though it's over half of my life. My biggest challenge was understanding that she first saw something in me that I did not see in myself. So it was a constant struggle on this mission and telling the story and being patient that things will fall in place. So all this that is happening now, I'm on cloud nine. I feel like I just felt when I got the case reopened in 2004, because my life haven't moved forward tremendously in my lifestyle and things of that nature, but it hadn't moved forward. What we're seeing in the film, 1955, is something that we're actually seeing today. I'm a firm believer. If we forget our past, history will repeat itself. And of course, over time, I had to believe in that. You know, I had to come to believe that even more because I see this happening in our midst right now. I see it happening in my life and something I never thought I would see. I mean, you hear your parents say it, you hear the elders say it, oh, history repeats itself. But it seems like a cliche when they say it, but now I'm living it. There's no other story that speaks to this generation and time than the story of Emmett Lewis Till because of the political, racial, backdrop that we see not only in the United States, but around the world. And so there's no other story that speaks to this generation than the story of Emmett Till. And so, unfortunately, and while thinking, I'm sorry, my will's attorney, Mother Mobley used to tell me all the time, when we depart from each other, if we're just getting off the phone with each other, she would always say to me, "Keith, you must continuously tell Emmett's story until man's consciousness is risen, because only then that would mean justice for Emmett Till." At a youngster, I didn't really truly understood what she was saying at that time. But those words were prophetic in many ways. And what she was trying to tell me, and it instilled in me, is that no matter how hard you continue to fight to get justice for Emmett Till, you may attain courtroom justice for him, but you still have to remember and won't stop the other Emmett Tills from happening. And so she was prophetic in many ways, and those words were prophetic. And unfortunately, that's what we're seeing in the United States and abroad. There's other Emmett Tills out there that she wanted us to be aware of, but she also wanted us to use the story of her son to show how ugly humanity can get, but also to understand the fight that must continue from this, because all these Emmett Tills of the day, and I keep saying all these Emmett Tills of the day, because it's very important that we don't play around with words on things that we see. Emmett Till's murder was a lynching. What we're seeing on the streets of America and abroad is legalized lynching. And so we have to understand that the two are one and the same, that we cannot disconnect or change the language. I know it's very hard to say lynching today. We do that in the U.S. But you have to call it for what it is, because when you say it's a murder or a killing, people say, "Oh, it's just a murder or a killing." When you say lynching, there's a certain immediacy that has to take place so we can continue to fight and make sure these things don't happen. So this is why the story is so important for us all to understand, because it's very important to awaken the sleeping giant in us again, that sleeping giant of change. Because if we could arguably say the civil rights movement was the greatest movement ever produced by citizens in America, a movement that benefited us all worldwide, we can honestly say this was the most successful movement of any day, because we haven't seen any other day. Of course, Black Lives Matter took place in our country and around the world, and we really felt that that was going to be the change that we've been longing for. But we haven't seen it. But if we could arguably say the Civil Rights Movement was the greatest movement ever produced by citizens in America, then we must look at the story of Emmett Till and understand what transpired in 1955 and the courageousness of Mother Mobley, her courageous decision to have an open casket funeral, because it was the murder of Emmett Lewis Till that led a 26-year-old Martin Luther King to take on the Montgomery bus boycott. He felt that the murder of Emmett Till was an intimidation factor to keep black people away from the polls. 1955 was an election year. It's because of Emmett Till's murder that Sister Rosa Parks, who I had the pleasure of meeting because I was Mother Mobley's close friend, who decided not to get up from her seat on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama, she said that Emmett Till was foremost in her mind that day. So without the murder of Emmett Till, we probably would have had a civil rights movement, but how much of an impact would it have had on society at that particular day and time? And also, Emmett is known as the sacrificial lamb and the catalyst of the American civil rights movement. What people don't realize, and why we say this, is because there is a significant connection from Emmett's murder and a clear connection to the movement, and that happened 4 days before Rosa Parks decided to get up from her seat on that bus in Montgomery, Alabama. There was a Till rally that was held at Dexter Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama, which was being officiated over with 26-year-old Martin Luther King, Dr. T.R.M. Howard, one of the civil rights heroes of 55, was actually giving a speech about the injustice of Emmett Till, and in the congregation, in the audience, was Sister Rosa Parks. That's the connection that, unfortunately, history don't want you to know. And I believe it's because they're afraid of another revolutionary change. So it's an ongoing fight.
Thank you. So we have some time for